The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is a great way to stay on top of China news in a few minutes a day with a daily email newsletter, a mobile phone app, and a website, subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm coming to you today from Washington, D.C. The notorious Jinyumi, Jeremy Goldcorn, is at home in Nashville, Tennessee, and joins us from there. How are you, Jeremy?
Very well indeed. It's a beautiful, steamy late summer day here in Nashville, which the locals complain about, but I think is the best weather ever.
I can't imagine why you could like that, but we're kind of celebrating the fact that the end of summer is nigh. Labor Day is upon us. And
it's terrible. It's a tragedy. I could do with another 6 months of this.
Wow. I have no idea. I don't understand you. But Jeremy, for 20 years, both of us lived in the global center of the counterfeit, the knockoff, the ersatz, the shanzhai.
The fraud, the fake. You forgot some words.
Yeah, sure. The fraudulent, the fake. I distinctly recall seeing you in Baifeng's old bar on Hohai, sporting one of those dodgy silk market North Face jackets sometime around the turn of the millennium. Guilty? Yes.
No, actually, no. That actually is a real North Face jacket. It was just very dirty.
Sure. Well, of course, it was also, you know, clothing and then handbags and eyewear and pharmaceuticals. And then by, you know, about 2009 or so, it was, of course, smartphones. And there was even that fake Apple store, right?
That's right. An entire Apple store in Yunnan somewhere that was completely fake.
And countless other things.
Too many other examples, really, really to mention. I mean, fake business people, you know, the service of renting out foreigners to serve as fake CEOs, lamb skewers, kebabs that were actually made of rat meat. Pretty much anything you could fake is faked. Cigarettes, Viagra.
You know, actually, cigarettes, not so much, as it turns out. I talked to this guy at Philip Morris who told me that you basically can't find counterfeit. You find lots of smuggled, but almost no counterfeit Marlboros. It's very strange. Now, I asked him why that was, and he explained something about how the economics work, but it turns out it's just not worthwhile to try to fake them. Anyway, today on Seneca, we are talking about the culture of shanzhai and how the whole discourse around it and related issues of, you know, knockoffs and fakes and counterfeiting and intellectual property, how that's all evolved over the last few decades. So we're delighted to be joined here in Washington by Fan Yang, who is assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, or UMBC. She has a new book out called Faked in China, Nation Branding, Counterfeit Culture, and Globalization. And she's here to talk about her work. The book is an exploration of the ways in which China has sought to come to terms with a global IPR regime in a time of really far-reaching globalization. It's an era sort of best symbolized by China's accession to the WTO, so she calls it in the era of the WTO. But it's an era to which China really came woefully underpowered. That's because China came without the chips that the developed world insists the game be played with, its brands, which is something really insubstantial and weak and subject to, you know, subversion or appropriation by Chinese actors, even as, you know, some Chinese actors have strived to create Chinese equivalents. Jeremy, you remember what it was like. Well, brands, as I used to theorize, prior to like 1990, consisted always of name of an animal and a color, or a color. And so it was like white rabbit or black cat or goldfish or it was white elephant batteries. You remember those days, right, Jeremy?
Indeed.
The good old brands. Some Chinese actors like try to play the game and win it. I'm holding in my hand right now an iGo battery charger, actually. From, you remember that guy, Feng Jun?
I do, yeah. One of those kind of entrepreneurial characters, sort of late 90s, early 2000s, very charismatic guy who started off selling knockoff electronics in Zhongguancun in Beijing, I believe.
Exactly. Well, I mean, he sort of got branding, but so he's one of these guys who's trying to, you know, play it to win it. But there's other people who reject it entirely and embrace that kind of defiant Shanzhai spirit. In any case, attitudes toward the phenomenon have evolved, and we're very happy to have someone here to help sort through how things have changed. So, Fan Yang, welcome to Seneca, and I hope I haven't too badly mischaracterized your book.
Not at all. Hi, Kaiser. Hi, Jeremy. Nice to be here.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Well, actually, as you and Jeremy both know, China is a place of contradiction.
Yeah.
And some of the ways that you've described my project really point to those kind of contradictions emanating from fakes or brands. And so that's something that I would like to capture in the book, which is this notion of brands and how it has shaped how the government or the people think about the nation. And as you pointed out, how China encounters globalization. Well, globalization is another process that's also characterized by contradiction. So I thought looking at brands and counterfeits would be a really good way to think about these contradictory encounters. So that's sort of the impetus for the book.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own personal background? You're from Hangzhou, is that right?
Yeah. I was born in Hangzhou, but I actually grew up in different parts of China. My parents met in Ningxia province in Yinchuan. Yeah, that's where they were part of the Sandown youths. But I traveled back and forth between Ningxia and Hangzhou as a baby. And I still know one line in Ningxia Hua, I think. Pingguo hao chi.
It's like apple like, is no, tasty. Pingguo hao chi, just said with bad tones.
Yeah, but I don't really know much else. Yeah. But my mom got a position later in Shenzhen University. So that's where I went as a 9-year-old, and I spent the next 10 years there growing up in Shenzhen. So watching lots of Hong Kong television, learning Cantonese and English at the same time. And then after that, I went to Shanghai for undergrad before coming to the States for grad school.
And how did you get interested in this area? I mean, in writing specifically about Shanghai?
Yeah, well, thinking
back, because of Shenzhen.
Exactly. Shenzhen is sort of the origin or place of origin for Shanzhai films or Shanzhai film sector or Shanzhai culture, if you will. But of course, Hangzhou is now home to Alibaba. And I don't know Jack Ma personally, but I
you
do
know
quite a few people who worked at Tencent, Teng Xuing, who started WeChat, which most of us use. So I think maybe it's simply fate that I have to write something about faked in China related to made in China and created in China.
Right. So we read a lot about fakes and counterfeits from China. I mean, it comes up every time there's a discussion about like Alibaba, which you mentioned, and especially Taobao. It's been an issue even before Charlene Barshefsky famously tried to sneak some counterfeit beanie babies out of the country and got caught. Isn't it just the case that developing countries with weak IP regimes will inevitably go to counterfeiting? I mean, isn't it just sort of a structural thing? Or does your book bring kind of different perspectives to this discussion?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you mentioned IP struggles seem to be pandemic in developing countries. So that brings up the question, do we want to think about China as part of the developing world? Well, in a way, I'm kind of arguing that China in some ways is simultaneously striving to join the first world by, say, the mechanism of nation branding, but at the same time also struggling with lots of third world problems, faking being one of them. And I think that my book intervenes in the discussion of using IP struggles as a lens to look at China's cultural transformation, which is, of course, entangled in economic, political, social processes. And more specifically, I think this focus on fake also kind of allows us to complicate this narrative of economic rise, and specifically through cultural terms. That's kind of what I intend to do.
Do you think you could sketch out the organization of the book and explain perhaps why you decided to take that particular approach?
Sure. After laying out some theoretical framework in the introduction, which we as academics are expected to do, I first discussed the rise of set of nation branding policies after 2001. That's what the year that China joined the WTO and also
won the Olympics. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so these set of policies were aiming to upgrade China into a not just a manufacturer of global brands, but into a creator of its own IPR eligible brands. And so these policies are kind of captured by the idea of from made in China to created in China. So from there, I look at a few counterfeit cultural artifacts that in many ways contest this imagined trajectory propagated by state or state entities. And these artifacts include the media discourse Shanzhai, which you just mentioned, and a pirate film called Crazy Stone. And then also the silk market in Beijing, Xiushuijie, some of you also know in the audience as well. So in the conclusion, I look at the relatively new discourse of the China dream or the Chinese dream, particularly in relation to this film called American Dreams in China, 中国合伙人. And so that's sort of the outline of the book. And as you can see, my approach to culture is perhaps a little different from, say, those scholars trained in literary studies. That is, I've kind of intentionally moved away from the more elite sites of cultural production. Sure. So whether it's art or literature, which lots of people have written about, but I kind of focus a little more on the popular. And it's about, well, to me, culture, it really is about meaning making. And so I'm kind of interested in this moment looking at just the fact that so many more people are able to join in the process of culture making, and in part that has to do with rise of new media and the access to new communication technologies from the internet to the mobile phones. And so that's what my approach is coming from. I'm from a cultural studies background.
So the word at the very heart of your book is this word Shanzhai.
Yeah.
And it's really the whole discourse around Shanzhai that your book focuses on. So let's first define Shanzhai and talk a bit about where this word came from and how it got popularized. And what it includes in a strict sense, what it connotes, because there's, you know, kind of a valence around it, maybe even a moral valence around this this word.
Yeah, when I think of a Chinese title or translation for the book, I like to think of it as 中国被假造. But Shanzhai definitely would be the equivalence of counterfeit culture, another word that I use in the subtitle of the book. And that's because there's a sense of countering in both terms. Counterfeit means counter-made, and Shanzhai also has that connotation.
Right,
but
that
just
kind of
back to
scoff law kind of.
Yeah, like, but back to your kind of really point of returning to the original meaning. Of course, the word is made up of two characters, Shan referring to mountain and Jai is fortress. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was funny because I went to Hangzhou not too long ago and I saw a restaurant sign that says Awa Shan Jai and something like 全国首创原生态山寨主题餐厅. And I had to remind myself, this is actually the original meaning, the indigenous mountain food that is being highlighted there rather than the Shanzhai that I talk about in the book. But anyway, well, it's when it gets to the connotation, that's when it gets really interesting. And some of the Chinese literary people will probably think of Shui Hu, water margins, or thinking about like the Maoist guerrilla warfare being sort of these countering forces, anti-establishment. So that's the countering notion that I'm really intrigued by. And in the Chinese press, as you know, it pretty much became a catch-all phrase for all things fake.
Could I just interrupt and clarify just a little bit more the original meaning of Shanzhai? So, I mean, we're talking about a mountain fortress that one would think is inhabited by rebellious people who don't obey the government. Is that correct? If you have to summarize it in a short sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep. Okay. And this is actually the term, all the study that I kind of incorporated was coming from how the Chinese press discussed, say, Shanzhai economy and Shanzhai culture. And so that's some of the references that they are making are precisely coming from, say, Shui Hu and all those other historic artifacts.
Shui Hu, for those of you who haven't read China's four great novels, Shui Hu, it tells a story about 108 kind of bandits, I guess we call them,
yep.
who live on Liangshan and in different constellations of contest and alliance. But they're all kind of, it's a Robin Hood like story, right? These are kind of lovable rascals, right?
And the English, it's usually rendered in English as water margin, right?
Right. Water margins. Isn't there a funnier English translation?
Outlaws of the Marsh, I guess, is the other one.
Outlaws of the Marsh and All Men
also,
Are Brothers.
Also, something like 100 Men and One Woman or something like that. I'm not entirely sure. Jeremy mentioned that there were all kinds of Shanzhai artifacts or personalities, if you will. And some of you might remember there's Jay Chou, Shanzhai Jay Chou, right. Shanzhai Zhou Jielun, and even there was a Shanzhai Chunwan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, explain that. There's the Shanzhai Chunwan, of course. I think most of our listeners know it's the Spring Festival Gala. It's this four-hour kind of ridiculous extravaganza that they hold
on TV
on Chinese New Year's Eve, on CCTV. But there was a Shanzhai one. It was in 2009, 10?
Yeah. Actually, before that. Yeah.
But
so tell us about that.
But, I mean, we first started to hear the word a lot in China around 2008. It suddenly seemed to explode into popular consciousness and become something that you saw on the internet and in the media every day. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I remember even some of my Chinese friends who weren't that media savvy. Weren't even 100% sure what it meant. Is that timeline roughly correct? And I mean, do you understand why that it happened at that time? Why was that the time when Shanzhai suddenly became a nationwide phenomenon?
That's a very good question. You were absolutely right that Shanzhai was a media buzzword in 2008. In fact, some journalists even named 2008 as the year of Shanzhai. But the discussion of Shanzhai actually started before that. And one reason that it got so popular, of course, again, had to do with new media. And this is a moment, if you recall, also a lot of online parodies also took off. So in 2006, there's Hu Ge's,
oh yeah,
the bloody case of a steam bun, yeah. Which is a parody of that movie that most of us hate, The Promise, Chen Kaige's film. And this example kind of goes to show everything labeled Shanzhai had this ostensible appeal to the people. And it's about do it yourself and oftentimes using the kind of new technologies now at their disposal. And this is why I like to think of Shanzhai as simultaneous a discourse about new media, but whether it's cell phones or the internet, but also a discourse mediated by these media, as well as their older counterparts, such as television and print.
You mentioned the mobile phone, and of course, a lot of the phenomenon of the Shanzhai is focused on the smartphone in particular, the Shanzhai Ji. It's probably what comes to mind for most people who know the word, what Shanzhai means. What is it about the phone in particular that makes it naturally the focus of any discussion of Shanzhai?
Yeah, I actually focus on the Shanzhai mobile phone because it gets at the material conditions that gave rise to the Shanzhai discourse. And we can't talk about the rise of Shanzhai Ji or Shanzhai cell phones without talking about the city of Shenzhen, the first special economic zone set up in 79 that absorbed a lot of the subcontracting chains for global tech firms. And this was a place where communication scholars Carol Wallace and Jack Chu have located an informal mobile phone sector. And often the sector makes use of their connections to the global supply chains and make a lot of these cheap no brand phones that are really at one third of the price of those real brands. And that's when CNN and other media outlets started calling these phones banded cell phones. Mm-hmm. So going back to the notion of banditry. But some of these phones, of course, already have these like fake logos on them, like Nokia or HiPhone. And sometimes they have these really outrageous look, like shocking look, 雷人. But oftentimes these phones are just kind of functional for a lot of people who can't really afford the real phones, the real brands to begin with. And these people, who are they? Migrant workers who have come from the countryside to work in those supply chains.
Right. And so they're often actually built by people who are working in the Foxconns and
some of the media sources describe this mode of Shanzhai production as sort of a guerrilla warfare, because it's a modular mode of production, unlike the kind of Fordism that you can associate with mass production.
Oh, right.
So it's very flexible in responding to market shifts and also government crackdowns. Yeah, so that's sort of the characteristic of the Shanzhai mobile phone sector. In a way, I kind of linked it to what Jack Chu calls the information haveless, the term that he uses to describe the working class people who may not have as much access to fancy technologies, but certainly can make use of something like the banded phone. And so that's kind of how Shanzhai became a brand for the people in a way, and it had a lot to do with the specific conditions of Shenzhen as a site.
I found that in discussing Shanzhai and reading about it on the internet, they seem to be two very different opinions that would emerge at different times. The one is that Shanzhai was kind of a shameful thing, showing that China lacked all originality and was just ripping off everybody. But there was another strong current of thought, which that some of the most creative people and ideas and products coming out of China were Shanzhai products, and that was where China's innovation was really happening. Sort of along those lines, and without getting too academic, do you think you could sketch for us how you think the arc of public discourse about Shanzhai has changed in China in recent years?
As you know, the whole Shanzhai phenomenon is still unfolding. I don't presume to have captured all of it, and although I do know friends who are continuously looking at it. But in my book, I decided to just look at three moments of the discourse. So the first moment I've already described above, which is the rise of Shanzhai cell phones in Shenzhen. This is prior to 2005. At that time, there were lots of online forums out of Shenzhen dedicated to discussing the production and distribution of Shanzhai phones. And so in these cases, the people who were making this bandit brand, they were the ones who were the working class. Right. And oftentimes they work both in the legit sector and the fake sector. And then there are the consumers of this brand, and they're the masses that make this brand sort of a market success. But I also look at this moment when lots of other online sites like Sohu or even Baidu pick up Shanzhai as sort of a object of cataloging. And this is when you can think of this kind of technological product got turned into a visual cultural form, if you will, because there's 10 shocking lists of Shanzhai phones, that which ones have the most ridiculous designs, that's the most multiple functions. And if you recall, this was actually before smartphones were smartphones as we knew it, but actually a lot of Shanzhai phones had the functions that we now would call features associated with smartphones. And that had a lot to do with, say, the needs of the information had less, because that likely would be the only piece of technology that's really significant in their lives. And so after these kind of two moments, I kind of think about how both of them share this notion of like the maker of this brand. You can't really locate it to a individual per se or even one corporation. Rather, behind this brand is the whole collective. And so this is where it's a very different kind of perception of creativity, if you will, than the kind of individual-based notion of creativity sanctioned by the intellectual property rights regime. But then I kind of move on to look at also how the China Central Television portrays Shanzhai.
As proxy, this was 2008.
Well, that would be for me a little bit reductive because there's always the sense that, oh, CCTV is the mouthpiece of the state. What I argue is a little bit different. It's actually the state being in need of CCTV to reinsert itself as sort of the leader of the nation, to kind of direct the nation toward branding the nation. Uh-huh. And so the way that they portray Shanzhai phones, immediately it's about try to economize this Shanzhai culture and try to kind of reincorporate that into making a brand for the nation. So what seems to be left out in this kind of rebranding of Shanzhai is the agency of the collective masses that help bring the bandit phone into a market success.
So I see a potential for an interesting tension on the one hand between a state that would see elements of Shanzhai culture as being aligned with its own discomfort with the global IPR regime, seeing them as sort of natural allies in their kind of techno-nationalism on the one hand. And on the other, this real discomfort that they're athwart China's efforts to join that global IPR regime. So I can see how states, whether or not CCTV is a proxy for it, how that discourse might change as the state's priorities vis-a-vis the global IP regime change.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like maybe how I might have approached the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely there in your book.
So, Fan, I mean, I'm the kind of non-academic type here, most resistant to academic discourse. And in fact, I even find the word discourse kind of difficult to say, but
it's not hard to pronounce.
I had too much of it in the 1990s at university, but maybe I could ask you to give us an example or two of the kind of cultural analyses that you perform. I was thinking perhaps a few things that our listeners may be familiar with, you know, the silk market or Xiu Shui Jie, or maybe the fake Apple store in Yunnan that we mentioned earlier, which a blogger sort of discovered and made famous, things like that.
Yeah, those are two pretty good examples. Let's go with those.
Yeah. Well, actually, did you know that that supposedly fake Apple store actually sold real products?
Sure.
Genuine.
Yeah, I did know that.
Yeah. And, well, Mitt Romney, who mentioned this case to charge China for stealing American IP, he didn't really know that part. But anyway, well, one of the claims I make when I analyze that case, which is kind of fascinating to me because I'm interested in space. And in that case, you have a case of a space being branded and kind of IP protected. Or in this case, really, it's the blogger who just decided to kind of self-enlist to become an advocate for the Apple brand to say that, oh, this is a fake store because it's not a legit retailer that's sanctioned by the corporation itself. Despite the fact that all the products on display, they turned out to be all coming from the actual source. So what to me, this case brings up some kind of contradiction within the intellectual property rights regime. Well, why is it the fact that the Apple Corporation decided not to really pursue any legal measures afterwards? Well, on one hand, you can argue that some of the staircases in the store are patented under Steve Jobs' name. But on the other hand, well, why is it not a good thing to have some free extra marketing personnel in the city like Kunming, where a real Apple store has not been set up yet? So in a way, this is a fake store that provided real service to the corporation. So it's really not really in the interest of the corporation to go after it. So that's one of the things that I look at in that case. But the Silk Street market is a little bit different. And the way that I look at it is to trace how this, as you know, started as an informal market in the 80s and went on to become a famous bazaar for fakes. But after 2001, when the city was trying to rebrand itself in preparation for the Olympics, they decided to demolish the site to turn it into an eight-story shopping mall. And the idea is to shift this fake orientation into more of a folk or traditional Chineseness being on display for the tourists that will be coming in for the Olympics. And what is ironic, though, not only did the fake sales continue, this privatization, what I call, of an urban space in the name of protecting a sort of a public interest to protect an urban landmark, if you will, it's actually making it possible for five global brands, including Gucci and Prada, to file a lawsuit against the developer. And this is very different from when the vendors were just loosely connected at the site, and it was actually not possible for global brands to go after them. So in that sense, these struggles over landmark, trademark, and IP offer another glimpse into the competing notions of culture, whether it's about meaning making or value making. That's kind of the tension that I bring out in my analysis.
One of the things that you talk about in your book is this idea of cultural imperialism. It's a, you know, a fairly loaded phrase here, but you raise, I thought, a pretty intriguing idea that the new gunships in this cultural imperialism are brands themselves. I mean, you mentioned Gucci and Prada just now, but these are in fact very weak weapons. Oh, can you explain what you mean by this?
Yeah, I don't believe I described brands as weapons per se, yeah, but I thought that's weak, right? Quite an interesting way to think about it. I would say that the operation of the brand is simultaneously more subtle and even perhaps more powerful than, say, a military weapon. The subtle part comes in when you think of the brand as an intangible thing. You can't really buy a brand as a consumer. It's right. Only traded on the capital markets. And it also operates on a global scale in the sense that its production is transnationalized. So think designed in California, assembled in China on the back of your iPhones. Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of an indication of that kind of global operation of the brand. But in part, because of all these characteristics, when it works as a weapon, it doesn't work as an invasion, as, say, old-school imperialism would. Not. Rather, it produces contradictions or contradictory outcomes. And in this case, I'm arguing that it produces nation branding on the one hand and counterfeit culture on the other. Yeah.
So perhaps we could talk about nation branding a little bit more. You know, a major thread of your book is about China's attempts at nation branding. And, you know, Kaiser, you've worked at a big ad agency, which shall remain nameless, in China. And that, amongst, you know, most of the major public relations firms operating out of Beijing and Shanghai work for governments and help to brand states, you know, often starting with tourism. But, you know, some of America's biggest and most respectable PR agencies, one in particular I'm thinking of, has been working for the Russian government, for Putin, trying to make Russia's image in the West more appealing. So, Fan, could you talk about China's efforts to brand itself and what this has to do with Shanghai and with the intellectual property regime?
Mm-hmm. The PR shops actually do call that practice branding states. They're very, uh-huh. very upfront about it.
Yeah. I want to say that the terms that you've described in relation to Russia and others is the more perhaps typical way of using nation branding, which is describing a set of state branding strategies. As it is, you can expect, it's really referring to how national governments wanting to project a positive national image to the domestic and global audiences at once. For me, I use this term a little differently. I try to describe a whole set of policies which range from those that foster urban creative clusters to those that promote cultural tourism or those that nurture new media projects like video games or animation production. So the whole idea is to move away from the more low-end made-in-China model toward a greener, service-oriented, created-in-China model. And one thing that Shenzhen as Bandit Films have been able to do actually was to be some of these like state-supported brands to go out. So if you recall 1997, Jiang Zemin had this notion that all these like major enterprises need to go abroad, go global. But somehow Shenzhen cell phones in particular, were not only popular in China like just before 2005, and they were very popular in other parts of the developing world, like India and Africa. And so they formed a sort of a globalization from below, something that the state sponsor brands were really hoping to do. And so there's sort of a schism between the state's intent to globalize the state brands versus the Shenzhen success in the global market. And so this is why I argue that the state was needing to reshape the Shenzhen discourse as a brand for the nation, and so that it can become congruent to this vision of creating in China.
That is interesting. In South Africa, there's a slang word, Fong Kong.
Is it Fong Kong?
Oh, you know Fong Kong, right.
I was going to ask you about it. Yeah, a friend of mine who studies the China malls in Johannesburg told me about that word. I've been wanting to explore. So does it really have to do with like fake and Hong Kong?
Well, Fong Kong means cheap goods made in China, which could be Shenzhen or could just be kind of low quality, but they're cheap. People appreciate them, obviously, because, you know, 20 years ago, you needed a lot of money to buy an umbrella, and now, you know, you don't.
I remember. Yeah, I visited the China Mall in Johannesburg. That was right before Christmas last year. And then on that same afternoon, I went to this mall that's more American style. And of course, the China Mall was like full of people, but the American Mall was nearly empty. So that was an interesting contrast. So lots of people, not just from South Africa, but from other parts of African continent, were shopping there. So
last night, Jeremy, I had a drink with a guy by the name of Sean, who used to do PR for a major financial institution, and now has his own shop here in DC with a lot of Chinese clients. And he says that there are all these former Shenzhen brands who are building cell phones are beating a path to his store. They're all trying to get his services as a digital marketer, as a digital branding guy for the U.S. market. I mean, these are all, I think they're seeing these brands called like Meizu and Oppo and stuff like that, who are making a mark and who had humble origins as kind of quasi Shenzhen or full blown Shenzhen shops. Really fascinating. And he encouraged me to look at Kickstarter. He said that if you look at a lot of the tech areas around Kickstarter campaigns, that it's just filled with these Guangdong province-based Shenzhen shops that are doing some pretty spectacularly interesting technology and trying to escape their Shenzhen roots and become like legit brands.
But I mean, Fan, that really also brings me to a question which we haven't defined exactly, which is, I've always felt that there is a clear distinction between Shenzhen and fake. Like pure fake and counterfeit
mm-hmm.
is,
yeah, for sure.
Okay, it's pretending to be a Gucci bag, even though it's not made by Gucci.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Shanghai brands never actually, I mean, they may have been called Bokia instead of Nokia, but they never actually called mm-hmm. themselves Nokia. They were not trying to mm-hmm. present themselves as exactly a foreign brand. It's a different thing from a pure fake, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think that was actually part of the attraction for the kind of online catalogers that I mentioned before,
yeah.
that they were just intrigued by these manifestation of difference, even though it seems to predicate on some sort of similarity still. So yeah, I think it's definitely still worth exploring further as an aesthetic object. Yeah.
So, Van, you teach media and communication studies at UMBC. How does China fit into the courses that you actually teach? Are most of your students people with significant exposure to China or to
Not Chinese really, but in a way, that's a good thing
yeah.
for me. Although I am affiliated with the Asian Studies program
uh-huh.
at UMBC, I teach primarily in media and communication studies. And one course I've been teaching a lot is called a Media Communication and Globalization. I help create that course and really enjoy teaching it because it invites our students to think about how they participate in globalization through use of media and communication. And I use a lot of examples from China for obvious reasons. Well,
yeah.
One film that a lot of my students really love is Young and Restless in China that featured this one rapper from Beijing, Wang Xiaolei, that
uh-huh.
they just could not stop talking about him.
Jeremy, have you seen that?
Restless in Beijing.
Young and Restless in China.
Young and Restless, not Restless in Beijing. No,
I haven't. I remember Restless in Beijing, yeah. I think it was called. But
yeah, I remember that one too.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
Yeah, but there's some really interesting footage on like different young people, how they are making sense of the world. But the rapper is someone that just my students always invoke him when we talk about questions like, oh, is globalization Americanization and stuff like that. But of course, there's a documentary Manufactured Landscapes, which I think you might have mentioned it on this
Brzezinski,
program before.
Yeah.
And so there's some really great footage in it on the recycling of e-waste in China.
Oh, wow.
And so I think China is just too important a site for the globalization of media production, consumption, and recycling to ignore when it comes to teaching media and globalization. And so I really enjoy doing that. And I appreciate the fact that I don't teach in a straight China studies course. And a lot of my students are really interested in exploring topics related in China, even though they may not have their language background. And at the same time, I really enjoy having conversations with them about China in the contemporary world order. And that's something that I've attempted to do in my research as well. It's to situate China in contemporary globalization.
That's fantastic.
Terrific.
I mean, it recalls, I think it was Pierre Rexman, whose pen name was Simon Lace, who said that, you know, one of the reasons he began to study Chinese was that if you don't understand something about China, how can you possibly understand anything about the world? Which is something
mm-hmm.
that I feel quite strongly is true.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
We're kind of getting towards the end of the podcast, but I'd like to ask you, what are you working on now? You know, what interests you these days as a media communication
yeah.
and cultural studies person who's from China and does some work on China but is working in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm working on a new project called Chimerica, which looks at what I call the imaginary amalgamation of China and America in a number of transnational media artifacts. So some of the examples you might think of, the cult TV series Firefly, Netflix series House of Cards, Season 2, especially, or any number of Hollywood sci-fi films that feel the need to include some China. Yes, right. So whether it's Gravity or The Martian. So I guess I'm really increasingly interested in how China is imagined in the U.S. popular culture and politics, and trying to think about how the transnational media deal flows made that kind of imagination impactful in the political arena. And
well, when you're ready, you know, come talk to us about this. This is just the sort of thing we'd love to chat with you about.
Of course. I want to pick your brain on it too, actually. Yeah. Another thing I'm really interested in, as Jeremy was mentioning before, China Mall in Johannesburg. I'm really interested in China's growing presence in the global south, especially after that conference to South Africa. So that's another thing that I like to pick your brain on as well.
Well, pick away. We're going to go get dinner afterward and we can start that conversation. Anyway, Fan, it has been great to have you on the show. It's a pity, Jeremy, that you weren't able to join here. It would have been fun. We're all going to go eat at the...
Damn you all.
Get on the plane now.
Before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at SupChina News and on Facebook at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. Recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you kick us off with some?
Okay, I've been unpacking some of my books from China, and I think I may have recommended one of these in the past, but it's worth another recommendation. These are books, it's very different from our subject of the podcast today, about wildlife. So three books. One is A Guide to the Mammals of China, edited by Andrew T. Smith and Xie Yan, who's listed as Yan Xie on the book, and published by Princeton University Press. So it's a color illustrations of pretty much all the mammals found in China, together with very detailed notes about where they're found, their habits, their diet, and all kinds of things that you would need to identify mammals. And if you're interested in that, you'd probably also be interested in A Field Guide to the Birds of China, by John McKinnon, Karen Phillips, in collaboration with He Fenqi, which was published by Oxford University Press. And it's quite a thick book. It covers the whole country, you know, from Xinjiang to the forests of Yunnan to the big wastes, wintry wastes of Dongbei. So if you live in Beijing, as I used to, I'd also recommend a Chinese book called Beijing Yanyao Tu Jian, which is a photo-based guidebook to the birds of Beijing, published by Beijing Chuban She, Beijing Press, I think, and edited by a fellow named Gao Wu. So those three books.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, Fan, what do you have for us?
Well, since G20 is around the corner and I happen to have just returned from my hometown, Hangzhou, I figure I would just offer two recommendations from my hometown.
Okay.
One is a bookstore, Zhongshuge Xingguangdian, which is located in the new city, Qiantang Xincheng, which is different from the Westlake. And it's one of those like illusion bookstores, if you will, like lots of mirror designs in it. To me, it really beats the Apple Store, fake or real. Another recommendation is a restaurant, a new branch of an old restaurant, really, Wei Zhuang, which is a branch of the old restaurant called Zhi Wei Guan. And it's located right by the West Lake. And I imagine it would be nice in fall weather to sit outside and look at the West Lake while you enjoy some Hangzhou cuisine. And a week ago, 2 weeks ago when I was there, I realized while eating lunch there, that like how much of Hangzhou cuisine was lake to table, like before farm to table was the thing.
Yeah,
and so we've been talking a lot about fakes here, and if you're really up for authenticity, quote unquote, well, that's what I would recommend, Hangzhou cuisine in Wei Zhuang.
Great, excellent recommendation. My recommendation for today is a book, and specifically an audio book. It's called Underground Airlines. The author is Ben H. Winters. It was a New York Times bestseller. It's a work of alternative history of sort of one of those, what would it have been like? And the premise is that the Civil War was never fought in the United States. Slavery persisted. In what are, you know, in this book are the four hard states of the South. It's ended in Georgia, but it's in the merged entity of North and South Carolina and in a couple of other states. Slavery persists, and it's a first person account written in a kind of noir style about a himself, a freed slave, who is working as a fugitive slave catcher. He's a very interesting personality. The writing is excellent. It's written very much like a screenplay. The narration is phenomenally good. It's narrated by a guy named William Demerit, and I highly recommend it. It's a relatively short read, so next time you're taking a 5-hour, 6-hour long drive, pop that one in. It's thrilling from beginning to end.
So who's the non-academic type of guy? You guys are making me look bad. I'm not recommending books. You guys are all about books.
I'm recommending an audio book. It's sort of a fun one. You know, it's sort of in the spirit of The Plot Against America by Philip Roth. You know, again, it's one of those books that it's maybe a good timely one to read in the age of Donald Trump. Thanks, young
fan.
Thank you. It was just wonderful to have you here, and we look forward to hearing more from you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeremy, man, good to talk to you.
Yeah, a pleasure. Once again, a shame I couldn't be there in person, but I hope the sound is good enough.
I'm sure it will be. We tested it. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo, myself, and Jeremy Goldcorn. Special thanks this week to Anla Cheng, Amadeo Tumalulo, and Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email. We love hearing from you at Seneca@supchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/Seneca Podcast. And of course, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @Seneca Podcast. Thanks very much for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.